Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com. And today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a question more and more people are asking, including those who have worked closely with Trump, and that is he losing it? Is the president crazy? Joining us is William Cohan, a former senior Wall Street investment banker and best-selling author who writes a biweekly column at the New York Times and is a special correspondent for Vanity Fair, where he has an article, Oh My God, This Jackass. The Mooch explains why he thinks Trump is crazy, narcissistic, and a paper tiger who will drop out by March of 2020. We will discuss the interview William Cohan did with the short-lived director of communications at the Trump White House, Anthony Scaramucci, and the committee to dismantle Trump PAC that the Mooch is launching to find a Republican challenger to run against Trump in the presidential primary. While many people who have dealt with Trump over the years have found him to be a self-obsessed narcissist on the borderline of insanity, Scaramucci believes Trump's mental faculties are declining as he becomes more petulant and impetuous. He also refers to the Game of Thrones in arguing that once Trump is primaried, Republicans will desert him, quote, the minute the Night King is vaporized, all the zombies are going to fall by the wayside. Then, with the Trump administration stripping Title X funds from Planned Parenthood and Trump accusing Jewish Democrats of disloyalty, we will speak with Amanda Marcotte, a feminist author who writes for Salon, where she has two articles, Why Are Republicans Taking Away Birth Control? Because They Don't Want Women to Have It, and Trump's anti-Semitic comments are the new normal. Threats and blackmail are all he has left. Then finally, we will discuss Trump's cancellation of a state visit to Denmark because the man-child thinks the Danish Prime Minister was nasty in rejecting his offer to buy Greenland. An expert on European politics are Daniel Kellerman, the Jean Monnet Chair and a Professor of Political Science at Rutgers University, joins us to discuss the difficult task European allies have of wanting to deal with the United States, but not the childish buffoon who pouts at the Danish Prime Minister's spurning of his ridiculous offer to buy Greenland. Quote, she's not talking to me, she's talking to the United States of America. They can't say how absurd. And joining us now is William Cohan, who's a former senior Wall Street investment banker for 17 years at Lazard Frères & Company, Merrill Lynch and J.P. Morgan Chase, as well as a New York Times bestselling author, whose books include Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World, and House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street. He's a special correspondent at Vanity Fair and writes a biweekly opinion column at the New York Times. And he has an article at Vanity Fair, Oh My God, This Jackass, The Mooch Explains Why He Thinks Trump is Crazy. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Cohan.
Well, it's great to be here, as always, Ian.
Well, thanks, Bill. And the Mooch is, since you cover Wall Street and you know all the players, including Trump, not that he was blackballed from Wall Street, but still, what's Mooch's kind of credentials in that world, in the sense that he's trying to primary Trump, and he's talking about forming a political action committee, tentatively named the Committee to Dismantle Trump. Does he have, unlike Trump, does he have credibility on Wall Street?
So, you know, I think Anthony has a lot of credibility, not necessarily, you know, as, you know, the world's greatest, you know, investor or hedge fund manager. He runs a hedge fund that is a fund of funds, so his job is to select other hedge funds and invest people's money in that, and I think he's done a pretty good job of that. You know, I don't know that he's like the, you know, in the top performing hedge fund, but he has managed to, you know, because he's an incredibly charming guy, a great salesman, has been able to attract a lot of money to his funds. And so, I mean, you're not going to see him listed among the world's great stock pickers. You know, he's not a private equity guy. He, you know, he worked at Goldman Sachs, had two tours of duty there. Not the world's greatest banker. He's not the world's greatest private equity guy. He's not the world's greatest hedge fund guy. But he is sort of a somebody who sort of combines some of those skills with great marketing and sales ability, and he's a bit of an impresario. And of course, he has this, you know, SALT conference every year that he ran, except for the year that he was in the White House in Las Vegas, where he assembles, you know, an incredible collection of people. I have interviewed people there on stage. I've always been impressed by that. I think that's probably, frankly, one of his biggest claims to fame on Wall Street, is that his ability to pull together this SALT conference every year in Las Vegas. And so, I mean, I think he's somebody who, you know, sort of parlayed his 15 minutes of fame into something more substantial than that. And I think he's really onto something this time.
Well, in your interview that you did with him in Vanity Fair, "Oh My God, This Jackass," the Mooch explains why he thinks Trump is crazy. You ask him the question, and what was the moment the scales actually fell from your eyes? Because he was in the White House briefly, 11 days, but then he stuck with Trump. And then your question is, what changed it? And he said that, talking about Trump's racism, he's saying he's not a racist. He's actually worse than a racist. He is so narcissistic, he doesn't see people as people. He sees them as objects in his field of vision. And therefore, that's why he has no empathy. And that's why he got his thumbs up in the air when he was taking a picture with an orphan. Of course, we all know how hideous that picture was. So that's, I mean, is he a little late in figuring that out? I mean, is that the breaking point, do you think?
Well, I mean, for a lot of other people, the breaking point was long before that. But, you know, I've had, I mean, to some extent, you know, Anthony, you know, where have you been? What took you so long? But, I've talked to him and written about him through this whole period, sort of beginning in and around 2015. I mean, I talked to him earlier from my book about Goldman Sachs, because he had worked there. I had written a book about some of his time at Goldman Sachs. So that's when I first got to meet him, you know, like 10 years ago. But back when he was trying to, you know, he's always been very interested in politics, and especially Republican politics, and he wanted to be involved in politics, and he has been in previous elections prior to 2016. He's been involved in sort of bundling money and sort of having a seat near the table. I wouldn't say necessarily at the table, but, you know, in the vicinity of the table. And I think this time, you know, he started off by supporting Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin, and of course he was the first flame out in the 2016 primary season. And then, you know, the Mooch very skillfully sort of thought, well, okay, now I'll go with Jeb Bush. You know, that's where the smart money is. I mean, Jeb Bush had the backing of something like $100 million worth of money from Wall Street, and he tried that. And of course, Trump, you know, destroyed Jeb Bush. And then again, to the Mooch's credit, to Anthony's credit, he was able to parlay those first two mistakes into supporting Trump again at a time when very few people on Wall Street were doing so. I remember I was at the SALT conference in the spring of May of 2016, April of 2016, I believe, and Steve Mnuchin had just been announced as sort of the co-chair of Trump's finance committee, and he was at the SALT conference, and he was there trying to raise money for Trump. And, you know, to Anthony's credit, he sort of cozied up to Mnuchin, who he either knew or was aware of when he was at Goldman Sachs, and, you know, parlayed that into, bigger support for Trump, and ended up on Trump's transition committee after he had gotten elected. He was like one of 15 people, and that, I think, speaks to Anthony's, ability to sort of recover from supporting the wrong guy and getting along with Trump, whether you agree with him or not, and sort of fulfilling his hope of getting more and more involved in Republican politics. And again, the odds were against him. Most people who are on the transition committee of a candidate get a job in the White House. There were people who were trying to block Anthony from doing that. They used this sort of sale of his company, Skybridge Capital, to a Chinese insurance company, as as a reason why Anthony could not be in the White House in a staff job. And he got through all that and then, you know, finds himself, there was talk of him being like head of the Ex-Im Bank. There was talk of him moving to Paris for Trump. And, you know, he parlayed, somehow he parlayed it all into being communications director, which, of course, he had no experience with. But, you know, he's a very good communicator. He's gets along great with people. He's on television. He looks good. And, you know, then he sort of blew himself up, you know, after 11 days giving that interview to Ryan Lizza at The New Yorker. You know, the Mooch is an interesting character. I don't know where he takes this, but I'm telling you, he's more a man of the people than you would expect, and I think he's really has a sense for which way the political winds are blowing, and I think he's correctly perceived that people have just had enough of this guy.
Now, my sense is, you recall, Bill, when the White House tapes were first made available during the Nixon administration, the scales came off people's eyes that the president was cursing and saying, you know, all kinds of politically incorrect things. But if you could get a camera into the Oval Office and see how Trump really is, and apparently he's much, much worse than when he first came on the scene. I talked to businessmen who had dealt with him over the years, and they said he was just totally self-obsessed, narcissistic, completely all about himself and totally nuts. That was a long time ago, relatively speaking. The theory is now that he's getting worse, and Scaramucci says, just from your article at Vanity Fair, quoting him, "I think the guy is losing it mentally. He's becoming more petulant and he's becoming more impetuous." And then you ask him, "What do you think people got wrong about Trump?" And he said, "I don't have Trump derangement syndrome, but I have Trump fatigue syndrome." So that kind of supports what you're saying, doesn't it? That do you think the public is tiring? My sense is that maybe short of having a Howard Beale moment where Trump just goes completely nuts on camera like Peter Finch in Network and says he's mad as hell, he's not going to take it anymore, the idea of getting a camera into the White House would do the trick. But there is this amazing wall that's protecting him. And do you think Scaramucci can chip away and break down that wall?
Well, first of all, I think he's absolutely right that people have Trump fatigue syndrome. I mean, those people who weren't already repulsed by him, I think an increasing number, an important increasing number, are just tired of him, tired of the drama, the embarrassment. I mean, look even today, I mean, you know, calling out the Prime Minister of Denmark because she refused to say no to his idea to buy Greenland in a nice way. I mean, canceling his trip. I mean, I think he obviously, part of his strategy is to be create chaos each day in these increasingly outrageous ways that a normal politician would never even conceive of. So he's creating chaos on a daily basis to try to deflect from, you know, his incredible failings. You know, I'm not exactly sure what he's necessarily trying to deflect from, but he needs the attention on him. He tries to obfuscate and create chaos every single day. It's incredibly effective, and I'm not even sure we understand all the things that he's up to, all the things that he's doing, and the legacy that he's going to leave us with. And so I think that the Mooch is really onto something when he says people have Trump fatigue syndrome. And all those people who last time decided they didn't like Hillary Clinton, didn't want to vote for her, and would, you know, give this guy a chance. Now, notice in New York, we knew what he was really like, and he, you know, lost New York in a landslide. Unfortunately, we could not convey what we knew to the rest of the country. But I think they're getting the message now. And I think that on the margins, people are sick of him, and I think that he will not be able to put together the Electoral College coalition that he was able to do last time, because I think people in the swing states like you know, Pennsylvania or Michigan or Wisconsin have really gotten the message, and I just don't think he's going to have the kind of success there that he had last time.
Well, I think his insurance with the Republican Party is surely the record of people who challenged him and who criticized his vulgar behavior and his incompetence. like Senator Corker, for example, he's gone. He's had to retire. John McCain has died, of course. Senator Jeff Flake has also retired. So the message is out there, isn't it? That's why the Republicans are afraid of him. If you take this guy on, he'll destroy you. And if he doesn't destroy you, he'll have you primaried by somebody further to the right of you. And what I got from your interview with Scaramucci in Vanity Fair, William Cohen, is that Scaramucci feels that he can find somebody that could primary him. The kind of person that Scaramucci's talking about, who the country needs, is a bit like Ben Sasse, for example. He said he wants a younger guy. Ben Sasse is a decent guy from all accounts. But I think he's cowed by Trump too, isn't he?
Well, I mean, I don't know what Ben Sasse is actually thinking. I know that people are talking about, Nikki Haley potentially primarying him, the former UN ambassador. Obviously Bill Weld has already started, he has a campaign trying to go against him. I think there are other people who are thinking about it as well. I mean, look, I think that, Trump, for whatever reason, which I do not understand, he's got this, stranglehold lock on the Republican Party. But I think the Republican Party is getting smaller and smaller and smaller, so I'm not sure what that means. So when you've got, a 90% approval rating from the Republican Party, that may be nice. That may ensure your nomination is the nominee of the party for president. But you're talking about an increasingly smaller number of people in the Republican Party. I just think that people have, as Anthony said, have had enough. We've seen what this guy's like. We've seen the bluster. It's too much. We can't take it. This is not what we want our president to be like. He's embarrassing us internationally. I think, frankly, the economy is literally on the brink. We've got trillion-dollar budget deficits, $22 trillion of long-term debt for the country. He said he was going to eliminate those things. He's done the exact opposite. The economy is starting to slow down. People's wages have not kept pace. The cost of living is increasing. People are taking way too much risk. Jawboning the Fed into lowering interest rates was the exact wrong thing to do. Who knows what he's up to, frankly, with the tariffs, which is incredibly inarticulate at explaining what he's doing or why he's doing it. And it seems like it's just a way for people he knows to cash in the market by going long and then going short, waiting for his strange pronouncements on the tariffs. So I just think that people have had enough. I think he's going to, whoever the nominee is, I think is going to have a powerful victory in 2020. And I know it doesn't seem that way, but I'm telling you, my gut tells me that obviously he's not going to get any Democrats, but the people on the margin who thought they'd give him a chance last time because they couldn't stomach the idea of Hillary Clinton, now I think they understand what he's all about and have had enough. So I frankly am optimistic for 2020, and that's even before the economy craps out, which I think it will before the election, and then that should seal his fate.
Well, you asked Scaramucci, you talked about Trump's poll numbers of being bad at this stage, and do you think he might drop out like Lyndon Johnson in 1968? And Scaramucci had already said that he sees Trump as a paper tiger. He can be completely dismantled and defeated. And then to answer your question about LBJ, he said that I think Trump's likely to drop out by March of 2020 because his ego is such that when he sees the polls, he sees certain defeat. But one of the things that is terrifying from my point of view is, as bad as Trump is, we know his background in business is absolutely criminal, but we don't know whether or not he's a traitor. And and from his relationship with Epstein, we don't know whether or not he could even be a pedophile. There's so much horrible stuff out there about this man. And one of the things that I find really disturbing, Bill, is that I follow the Russian press, and the Russians are saying our boy Donald is doing great. He's going to be re-elected. The people run against him are a bunch of lightweights. And in the next 3-4 years, Trump is going to sit down with Putin and Xi Jinping, and they're going to get rid of this whole idea of the liberal world order. And basically, they're implying that these three despots are going to carve up the world like three mafia bosses. So that's the way, that's the dark side, you know? So I don't even know that the guy's going to be held accountable. He's certainly not being held accountable for what Mueller found out about him. But I think the really dangerous stuff and the horrible stuff about him and the questions, he's still trying to help Putin out for whatever reasons to this day. And he didn't even ask Putin about this nuclear accident that went on, you know? It's just something incredibly strange about what's going on with Trump and Putin and Russia.
Well, there's no question about it. I mean, he's got to have something over Trump. He's got to have him, you know, whether it's women, whether it's loans, whether it's money, you know, whatever. He obviously has something over him. I've never, you know, Trump will insult anybody, and he's never insulted Putin. He's never insulted Xi. So he insults our allies and praises our enemies, which I find fascinating. But I really just get back to the whole idea. I think people, as Anthony said, I think people have had enough. I think he's a little bit too optimistic on thinking that he's going to drop out of the race, because one thing about Trump is that he just likes to double down and triple down. He likes doing the exact opposite of what you think he's going to do. And I don't think he's going to drop out of the race. I don't think he's going to be like Lyndon Johnson in 1968. But I do think that he is going to get a resounding defeat at the polls in November 2020. And I think that's like the best thing that we can hope for, because obviously Nancy Pelosi is not going to push impeachment proceedings, which I frankly, whether it could succeed or not, and obviously it probably wouldn't succeed in the Senate, I think is an important catharsis for the country to go through, so that we can reveal just how hideous and obscene this guy's behavior has been repeatedly. I think that would be a good thing for the country, whether or not he ends up getting actually convicted in the Senate or not. I think that would be a good thing for the country, but I think that since that's not going to happen for whatever reason, I think the best thing now is just a resounding defeat at the polls, which will be, you know, plenty humiliating for this guy, just what he needs. And then, you know, then the U.S. attorneys or the district attorneys or wherever can go after him for his crimes that he committed while he was in office. And, you know, with any luck, he'll be wearing an orange jumpsuit like Jeffrey Epstein.
Well, just in closing, the reason I brought up the Russians was that it has to be a resounding defeat, because they will surely help him as they did in 2016. And that is appalling. And the idea that the head of the Senate, Mitch McConnell, will not do anything about stopping the Russians meddling again. So he has to be defeated sufficiently that the Russians can't help fudge the results. And of course, they would like to create chaos no matter what. So I guess...
Well, I think that's what's going to happen, frankly. I really do. I think enough, obviously the Democrats would never vote for him, but I think enough people on the margin, people who voted, gave him a chance last time, have seen more than enough, and they're just sick of him.
Well, from your lips to God's ears, Bill, and I thank you very much for joining us.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with William Cohan, who's a former senior Wall Street investment banker for 17 years at Lazard Frere and Company, Merrill Lynch, and J.P. Morgan Chase, as well as the New York Times bestselling author, whose books include Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World, and House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street. He's a special correspondent at Vanity Fair and writes a biweekly opinion column in the New York Times, and he has an article at Vanity Fair, Oh My God, This Jackass, The Mooch Explains Why He Thinks Trump is Crazy.
We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back with more of Background Briefing on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com.
I think you're crazy. Hey, pro-lifers need to dig themselves, because life don't stop after birth. And for a child born to the unprepared, it might even just get worse. The situation would surely change if they were to find themselves in it. Supporters of the H-bomb and firebombing clinics.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Amanda Marcotte, who's a feminist author, blogger, and a politics writer for Salon. She's the author of Troll Nation, How the Right Became Trump-Worshipping Monsters Set on Rat-Effing Liberals, America and the Truth Itself. And her latest articles at Salon are Why Are Republicans Taking Away Birth Control? Because They Don't Want Women to Have It. And Trump's anti-Semitic comments are the new normal. Threats and blackmail are all he has left. Welcome to Background Briefing, Amanda Marcotte.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And let's start with the article about why Republicans are taking away birth control. And, of course, they've essentially forced Planned Parenthood out of the business. I mean, they literally had to cut their ties with the government because they couldn't live with the strictures that the Trump administration are placing on the money that they were getting from the government under these Title X grants. And essentially what's happening now is that a lot of particularly poor women in this country will not be able to get cancer screening tests. They won't be able to get screening for STDs, and they won't be able to get birth control. So if you are opposed to abortion, why would you not want to make contraception available? Because if you want to make abortions rare, then the best way to do that surely is to make contraception available.
Well, I think what this exposes is that the anti-choice movement, the anti-abortion movement, has never been about fetal life or being against abortion because it takes life or anything of that nature. It's always been about not wanting women to have control over their own reproductive capacity. And so they oppose contraception access for the same reason that they oppose abortion access, which is both make it easier for women to decide when and how they become parents. And the anti-choice movement simply does not think that should be a woman's decision.
Well, whose decision should it be then in their mind?
Well, I think when you kind of dig in, you find a lot of rhetoric about how there's shouldn't be a decoupling between having sex and becoming a parent. That if any woman thinks that she's ready to have sex, then she should be ready to be a parent. That you should wait for marriage if you want to have sex, and even within marriage, you know, you should be open to getting pregnant. So I think that's kind of what's going on here. I would also say that trying to really try to logic out what they expect women to do and how they expect these things to go is probably a fool's game. A lot of these kind of conservative reactionary ideologies don't think 10 steps ahead. They just are mad that women have control. They know that birth control and abortion helps women get more control over their lives, and they want to take that away.
So I haven't been able to find any studies or any polling or any efforts to find out why these people think this way. Have you come across anything? I mean, have you actually talked to these kind of people who believe the so-called right to lifers, particularly if you confronted them with the illogic of what's happening now with Planned Parenthood and taking away birth control, particularly from poor women, along with denying them access to cancer screening and to test for STD, which apparently STDs are on the rise in this country. All of those things seem to be against life in a sense, doesn't it? I mean, I just wonder if anybody's ever, I'm sure you're right, this is a fool's errand, but I'd be still interested to know what possible rationale has ever been presented when people are confronted with the illogic of this position that they're taking on this so-called right to life fundamentalism.
Yeah, I mean, I've done this for a long time. Going back into the Bush administration, I've been working on this subject. So this is why none of this is surprising to me. And it's always the same kind of merry-go-round when you are discussing this with people that hold these beliefs. You know, you say, well, if you don't support abortion, then you should want women to have contraception. And they say, well, no, what women should do is wait until marriage to have sex. And, you know, no matter how many ways you kind of point out the logic of that, like nobody waits to marriage to have sex. 95% of Americans have had premarital sex. Like, this is a nearly universal behavior. It's just, you can't get past the, well, they should. Well, they should. If you don't want a baby, then you should keep your legs shut. You know, it's always, they've often found nicer ways to say it, but that's kind of always the end point of these conversations. And you see this in the hiring that Trump has done with the HHS. Most of the people that he's kind of filled HHS with that are in charge of anything involving women's reproduction come from the world of abstinence-only programs and other kinds of like organizations like that promote this idea that premarital sex is inherently wrong, that the point that the government's role should be in trying to convince people, if including with a little bit of force by taking away health care, that they should be waiting for marriage to have sex. When you point out, of course, that married people also need contraception and abortion, they tend to get a little like, they tend to slide around a little on you with that, saying, well, you know, sure, maybe. The implication is often that married women have better resources so they can pay the full price for any contraception they might need. But mostly it's an obsession with this idea that single women are escaping, you know, their patriarchal duties to marriage, to virginity, to chastity, to celibacy, to motherhood, all these things because of contraception and abortion. That obsession does not hold up well to logical inquiry.
And again, I'm speaking with Amanda Marcotte, who's a feminist author, blogger, and a politics writer for Salon. She's the author of Troll Nation, How the Right Became Trump-Worshipping Monsters Set on Rat-Effing Liberals, America and the Truth Itself. And her latest articles at Salon are Why Are Republicans Taking Away Birth Control? Because They Don't Want Women to Have It. And Trump's Anti-Semitic Comments Are the New Normal. Threats and Blackmail Are All He Has Left. So, but would it be a better tactic on the part of the pro-choice movement? Obviously, pro-life is a stronger concept than pro-choice, but you don't want to be put in the position of saying, yeah, abortions are great, because they're not. Women don't like having them, and although clearly they are necessary under a number of circumstances. So if you could, can you turn that around and say, yeah, we're against abortion too, just like you guys are. That's why we believe in contraception. Does that work?
I mean, no, it doesn't work, because that is assuming that their reason for being against abortion is that they care about fetal life, and they don't. That's always been a bad faith gambit that is there so that they don't have to say what they're really about, which is taking away women's autonomy and trying to police people's sexuality. I mean, it's not a mystery here that the same people that oppose abortion tend to promote abstinence-only education and tend to oppose LGBT rights. This is all in the same bucket of trying to police how people express their gender, trying to police how people arrange their sex lives, you know, basically sticking their nose where it doesn't belong. So you can say that and liberals will applaud you. And I mean, I'm not opposed to saying, you know, I don't like the flu, so I think you should get the flu vaccine. You know, abortion is painful, so you should get contraception. Preventive medicine is good, yes, but that doesn't mean that we should take away treatment for people who prevention didn't work for. I'll say that till I'm blue in the face, but it's not going to really change any anti-choice minds, because it's not addressing what they really care about, which is policing women and policing sexuality. That said, I do want to point out that the majority of Americans, like a strong majority of Americans, are in fact pro-choice. I think it was 70% of Americans in the last polling I saw want to keep Roe versus Wade as it is.
Well, but you were saying earlier that 90% of Americans have engaged in premarital sex. So the people that Trump is listening to, and who this is
Isn't this an amazing tyranny of the minority? You've got 10% of the country basically forcing their religious beliefs on the 90% and causing a lot of pain, particularly for poor women.
Yeah, I mean, it's even worse than that. Guttmacher statistics say it's at least 95% of Americans have had premarital sex, and that number just keeps going up. And I would point out that a lot of people that are pushing this ideology themselves aren't exactly living the lifestyle they want to foist on other people. I mean, Donald Trump has been married 3 times. He's cheated on all of his wives. His attitude about sex is that he should have as much as he wants with whoever he wants, whenever he wants, and yet he still feels entitled to police women's sexuality in this way. So I think it's really important to understand that there's no coherence, consistency, or decency here. It's just a very fascistic, authoritarian ideology that we're dealing with the anti-choice movement, and that's been true since the beginning of time. And I think we're only just now beginning to really absorb the public is only now beginning to absorb the hypocrisy of that because Trump has become a figurehead of it, and he's, you know, such a lech.
Right. Well, it's Trump and a bunch of Catholic priests who have been causing the Catholic Church to pay out zillions of dollars, too. I mean, if the Catholic Church could get over this celibacy impediment that they have, which is, I think, 900 years ago, they brought it in essentially to, as an issue about preserving property and not having to take care of widows and orphans. But if priests were to marry and women were to be ordained, the Catholic Church, I think its position on abortion would just almost evaporate. So the people that are the champions of the pro-choice are, if Trump is your figurehead and the fundamentalists in the Catholic Church, like Steve Bannon and company, are your ideologues, you're not on very firm ground.
Yeah, I mean, and you are right. I do think the critical issue here is it's a tyranny of the minority. I think most people want to just sort of live their lives. And one of the reasons that the anti-choice movement is able to be so powerful is because even though most people don't agree with them, there's still a lot of sexual shame that happens in this culture. There's a lot of people not wanting to talk about these issues. And so it's easy to sort of browbeat the opposition into silence because they don't want to talk about these things.
Well, let's turn to your other article at Salon, Amanda Marcotte. Trump's anti-Semitic comments are the new normal. Threats and blackmail are all he has left. Of course, I mean, it's so pathetic. The idea that today he's calling the Prime Minister of Denmark a nasty woman because she apparently insulted the United States, not him, he's saying, but she insulted the United States by saying the idea of buying Denmark is ridiculous. Well, it is ridiculous, and we know why Trump's doing it, because it's all about this reality TV distraction that goes on a daily basis to disguise the fact that he's completely incompetent, doesn't know how to govern. So he pulls off these reality TV stunts. So we have government by stunt. But I must say, looking at the Prime Minister making her statement in English, I thought, my God, you know, did you ever see that series Borgen, the Danish TV series about a female prime minister of Denmark?
No, I didn't.
Oh, it's a great TV show. In any case, this is the boorish buffoon that we have in the White House. Do you think, though, the idea of making Congresswoman Tlaib and the others the face of the Democratic Party and shaming American Jews into supporting Israel, I mean, he's doing so by literally revising an anti-Semitic trope that they somehow have dual loyalty. I think it's 3/4 of American Jews vote Democrat, and they tend to be on the liberal side. So is this effort to drive this wedge ever going to go anywhere apart from everything else that Trump does, which is about division, as opposed to healing this country?
I mean, I feel as an electioneering tactic, it's probably not going to be as effective as he thinks. I both think and hope that 2016 was something of a black swan event where women and other and people of color and other constituencies that tend to lean to the left just didn't come out and vote. They didn't take seriously the threat of Trump enough, unfortunately, and didn't turn out for Clinton as much as they should. But now that he's in office, I think that those people are woke.
Right.
Like, that didn't vote. And I think it's going to be very different. And the more he does this, the more he continues to insult women, the more he continues to insult people of color, the more he continues to insult Jews, the more determined they are going to be to vote against him. I think that that's probably not going to work the way he wants it to, but I also think that there's a real danger here, which is that he is encouraging terrorism. I think we can all just say that right now. Like, the shooting in El Paso just a couple weeks ago, the shooter was echoing Trump's rhetoric. The shooter in the Pittsburgh synagogue last year was echoing Trump's rhetoric. We've been seeing a rise in hate crimes. There have been, since the El Paso shooting, almost 30 people arrested for making threats, most of them hate crime related, of mass shootings. We are not going to see this go away anytime soon, because under Trump's management at the DOJ, they are de-emphasizing any kind of law enforcement response that could slow down the growth of white supremacist terrorism in this country. So, I mean, on one hand, I think he's in energizing the opposition. You often see that when a candidate is just a blatant bigot like he is. On the other hand, I think, there's a real danger that we're going to be seeing violence and ugliness on the rise for the next year and a half.
Well, proceeding on today's program, I spoke with William Cohen, who interviewed Scaramucci for Vanity Fair, and the Mooch is trying to organize a primary challenge on the Republican side against Trump. And he basically, he was asked, do you have Trump derangement syndrome? And the Mooch said, no, I have Trump fatigue syndrome. So do you think that might be the answer here, that people are just getting tired of this reality TV act that's going nowhere?
I hope so. I mean, it's an interesting question, because when people check out, they kind of often check out on the left side of the aisle more than on the right. So we're in a kind of unique situation here. I take comfort in the fact that there was a huge amount of turnout in 2018 for the Democrats, that it really was a record turnout for any election. But I will point out that voters on both sides of the aisle turned out in record numbers. It just happened to be that there are more people that tend to vote for Democrats, so when turnout goes up, they win. So I hope that trend line kind of continues. And I am kind of hoping that conservatives are getting a little tired. At least if even if just 5% of them just get sick of having to defend Trump all the time, get sick of having to pretend to respect this, like, buffoon in the office, that might actually just cause them to just skip voting in 2020. It seems impossible right now, but I remember in the Bush administration, there was a point where conservatives just gave up trying to defend George Bush. they gave up trying to defend the Iraq War and moved into phase two, which is the phase called pretending it all never happened, right?
Well, listen, the Democrats had better win big in 2020, because the Russians are going to help Trump again. So you already have to win by – the Democrats already have an 8% deficit because of gerrymandering. So they've got to get 8% more votes than the Republicans just to break even. And on top of that, with Russian meddling, they're going to have a blowout, at least 10, even 20%. on that note, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate talking with you, Amanda.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Amanda Marcotte, who's a feminist author, blogger, and a politics writer for Salon. She's the author of Troll Nation, How the Right Became Trump-Worshipping Monsters Set on Rat-Effing Liberals America and the Truth Itself. And her latest articles at Salon are Why Are Republicans Taking Away Birth Control? Because They Don't Want Women to Have It. And Trump's anti-Semitic comments are the new normal. Threats and blackmail are all he has left.
We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with more of Background Briefing on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is R. Daniel Kellerman, who's the Jean Monnet Chair and a Professor of Political Science at Rutgers University. He's the author of Eurolegalism, the Transformation of Law and Regulations in the European Union, and Lessons from Europe, What Americans Can Learn from European Public Policies. He also serves on the editorial boards of the Journal of European Public Policy and West European Politics and is a former member of the Executive Committee of the European Union Studies Association. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniel Kellerman.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us. And we've had yet another example of President Trump who praises America's adversaries, like particularly Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping, and trashes our allies. And Denmark is a NATO ally, and he's now calling the Prime Minister of Denmark nasty, or not a nasty woman, which is what he called Hillary Clinton. And what she said was pretty mild, suggesting that buying Greenland is absurd, and of course Trump basically saying that that's an insult to the United States. Quoting Trump, "She's not talking to me, she's talking to the United States of America." Well, that reminds me of de Gaulle, "L'État c'est moi." You know, Trump is saying he's America, and it's clearly about Trump, isn't it? It's not about America.
Well, it's absolutely about Trump, and I mean, I think frankly this story was one which I think a lot of people, when the story first came out, they were thinking, okay, this is sort of deep summer, silly season. But, you know, it turns out that not only was the story real about the speculation of about buying Greenland, but that it's actually led to these diplomatic repercussions. And, I mean, it's really disturbing. It's not nothing to cancel a state visit, right? That was a big event to have invited the president, and he was going to have, you know, dinner with the queen, et cetera. And, you know, to cancel it because supposedly, at least, you know, because of the refusal of Denmark to discuss this purchase of Greenland shows, you know, there was actually something going on there. And it is absurd.
Well, but he was invited. Trump was invited by Queen Margaretha II, and not by the prime minister, the 41-year-old Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen.
Well, I don't know all the details of the arrangement, but these kind of state visits, yes, you're invited formally by the head of state, but certainly, you know, I think it was arranged under the previous government because Denmark recently had a change of government, right, and a new prime minister. So it's true that she wasn't in place when the initial arrangements were made, but still, these kind of events are considered to be sort of state-to-state invitations rather than something, you know, depending just on who's the current prime minister. But in any case, it's a big insult to an ally. And as you mentioned before, you know, Denmark is a very close ally and a very reliable ally of the United States. Danish soldiers have fought alongside, you know, with the U.S. and Afghanistan and other places. So, you know, it's really insulting, and it's part of this broader pattern which you mentioned, which, you know, Trump is systematically alienating our close allies. You know, he ran the British or the UK's ambassador to the U.S. essentially out of town after that leak of cables incident. You know, you can go on and on. He's constantly insulting Germany and the EU as a whole. So it's part of a broader pattern of insulting and alienating our allies while coddling and, you know, cozying up to autocrats. Exactly.
So how are our allies and the European governments dealing with this? Because they obviously want to deal with the United States, but they don't necessarily want to deal with Trump.
Well, look, they have to deal with the Trump administration because it's the one in place. I'd say overall, the I think the broad sort of approach, you could say, maybe is twofold. On the one hand, you know, they're just trying to be patient, you know, dealing with the administration insofar as they can for now, but sort of with the hope that a different administration, you know, they don't explicitly say that, of course, but the hope is that a new administration will come to power after the next election and that they can restore the more traditional close ties between our European allies and the U.S. So that's what they're doing on one track. I think on the other track, at least, you know, some governments more than others maybe, but, you know, they're realizing, you know, they can't rely on the U.S. Maybe as much as they did in the past. They can't count on it because, you know, if Trump can come to power once, you know, someone with similar attitude, you know, he might remain in power, or someone with similar attitudes could come back. So I think they're thinking longer term about, you know, needing to you have more capacity to sort of confront the world on their own without reliance on, you know, the U.S.
Well, Trump, of course, is a Brexiteer, and Brexit looks like it could be a catastrophe, a crash out on October the 31st. It could actually start a recession. Certainly in the UK, they're going to lose about 10% of their economy overnight, and they're plunging into the dark. So it's an odd situation that so much of it is personal with Trump. I mean, he likes Hungary and Poland because they shower praise on him. But he's apparently, one of the subtext about his insults to, or his anger at, and canceling the trip to Denmark is that he was worried that Obama's going to be showing up there in a few weeks, and Obama would be greeted by a more enthusiastic and a bigger crowd. So that apparently is playing into it. So it is a very unusual situation to have a president who is almost petty and personal and childish in the way that he operates.
Well, certainly he is all those things. Look, I mean, we've seen a pattern of bizarre behavior, well, going back a long time, but really it's been intensifying in recent weeks with the series of, you know, statements we're getting from him, not only on Greenland, but on, you know, I am the chosen one. It could go on and on. So there's a lot of bizarre behavior, the sort of accusation that American Jews who vote for Democrats are disloyal or, you know, misinformed. So we're getting a bizarre pattern. And, you know, our allies have come to expect erratic behavior, unfortunately, you know, from the president sort of. So it's not just, let's say, that he made this ridiculous overture about buying Greenland, but that it's not like it was announced or approached through diplomatic channels. It kind of comes out, leaks out, and then there's tweets about it, you know, ridiculous things. But I think that is part of this broader pattern where his approach to diplomacy, if you can call it that, has made the U.S. an unreliable partner, you know, for our allies, unfortunately.
Well, apparently he's trying to get Vladimir Putin to back into the G8, now the G7. And Putin just met with the French president, Macron, and Macron said, yeah, you can join the G7 or make it the G8, but you got to deal with what's going on in Crimea and Ukraine. No such conditions does Trump place on Putin, and he didn't even apparently ask Putin about this nuclear accident that we don't know anything about. I mean, it's extraordinary. The Europeans must be wondering what the hell's going on.
Well, look, Ian, it's above my pay grade and security clearance, so to speak, not like I have one, but you know, to answer the question of whether, you know, Trump is some kind of Russian asset or that sort of thing. But let's just say this: his behavior, right, whether it's because he shares ideology with Putin or because Putin has dirt on him or all the various explanations, right, his behavior is totally consistent with what one would expect for someone who basically was serving the interests of the Putin regime, right? And that's repeatedly, in every turn, Trump's personal behavior, even if some U.S. policies are still standing up to Russia on certain issues, let's say like the Nord Stream pipeline, Trump's personal behavior and his kind of diplomatic moves individually are exactly what you would expect from someone who's trying to serve the interests of Putin. That relates both to this, call to let Russia back into the G7 or to make it the G8, despite the fact that Russia is still occupying illegally Crimea. But also, the Greenland thing, the exact story might be, let's say, a little murky, but Russia clearly has a lot of strategic interests in the Arctic region that are intensifying because with, basically the melting of some of the ice cover there, there's more opportunity for oil and gas exploration in the Arctic, including Greenland, right? So the kind of this sort of move to destabilize relationships with Denmark, which is another one of the Arctic, key actors, would be consistent with some sort of suspicious behavior serving Russian interests. So the whole thing, as you said, is bizarre and very disturbing.
Well, just in the last minute, is it possible that the Brexit disaster, assuming it happens, and it looks like it will on October the 31st, will that be a wake-up call? I mean, in other words, we can maybe undo the damage that Trump has done in November of 2020, but Brexit seems almost worse in a way.
Well, look, with Brexit, one thing, Trump is, of course, has encouraged Brexit from the beginning, and you've heard a lot in the last couple of weeks about promises from the administration that we would do a trade deal right away with the UK if they leave with no deal. First of all, that's not going to happen because any trade deal needs to be approved by Congress. And Congress, Pelosi and others, Schumer made it clear that they are not going to approve any kind of deal that destabilizes the border with Ireland, which a kind of no deal Brexit would do. So there's not going to be some immediate trade deal. And yes, I think it looks like, given the policies of the Boris Johnson government, we are probably headed for a no deal crash out Brexit on Halloween, and it's going to be a nightmare.
Well, Ardenia Kellerman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Daniel Kellerman, who's the Jean Monnet Chair and a Professor of Political Science at Rutgers University. And he's the author of Eurolegalism, The Transformation of Law and Regulation in the European Union and Lessons from Europe, What Americans Can Learn from European Public Policies.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
Standing along the side of the pickup truck, a shot rang out in the night. The headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door in 305 took the kids to the park and disappeared by 9:30. Who will ever know how much she loved them so? That dark night alone in America. A quiet voice is singing something to me, an angel song about the home of the brave and the slant here of the free. One time, one night. One more light goes on.